To enjoy this episode of Forensic Tales ad-free, check us out on Patreon. Patreon.com/ForensicTales.
Forensic Tales discusses topics that some listeners may find disturbing. The contents of this episode may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
In 2016, 27-year-old Myrna met up with a group of friends to grab some coffee. But less than 30 minutes later, she ended up dead after just a few sips of her drink. No one had any idea what could have happened to her at the coffee shop, until forensic evidence raised some serious and deadly suspicions. This is Forensic Tales, episode number 226, The Murder of Myrna Stalian. Welcome to Forensic Tales. I'm your host, Courtney Fretwell Areola. Forensic Tales is a weekly true crime podcast covering real, spine-tingling stories with a forensic science twist. Some cases have been solved with forensic science, while others have turned cold. Every remarkable story sends us a chilling reminder that not all stories have happy endings. As a one-woman show, your support helps me find new compelling cases, conduct in-depth fact-based research, and produce and edit this weekly show. You can support my work in two simple ways. Become a valued patron at patreon.com/forensictales and leave a positive review. Now, let's get to this week's episode. On January 6, 2016, 27-year-old Myrna Stalian met with some friends at an upscale coffee shop in Jakarta, Indonesia. She planned to spend the afternoon catching up with one of her longtime friends, Jessica Wongzo. The two hadn't seen each other in a while, and there was no better place to catch up than at a trendy coffee shop in town. However, she suddenly collapsed after one sip of her iced coffee. Hours later, she was pronounced dead. Was it a strange coincidence? Or did someone slip something into her coffee? Myrna Stalian was born on March 30, 1988, in Jakarta, Indonesia, the country's capital and largest city. She grew up with a twin sister and was the daughter of a very successful businessman. The success of her dad's business meant that Myrna and her twin sister experienced what anyone would describe as an upper-class and comfortable childhood. Anything those two girls wanted, they got. The money also meant Myrna and her twin sister attended one of the country's most prestigious high schools, where they both became fluent in English. After Myrna graduated from high school in 2007, she attended design school at the Billy Blue College of Design in Sydney, Australia. It was one of Australia's most well-known design schools and was every bit of Myrna's dream. Even from a young child, she knew she wanted to grow up to become a graphic designer. So being accepted to Australia's most well-known design school was a big deal to her and her family. But it also meant she would be far away from her dad and twin sister. Fortunately, though, her boyfriend also got accepted to college in Australia, so at least she had him. While studying in Sydney, Myrna met a lot of new friends who were also from Indonesia. It wasn't uncommon for students from wealthy families to attend school abroad in Australia. So it didn't take long for her to meet a great group of friends who were her same age and shared her same interests. Plus, Myrna was just the kind of girl who made friends easily. One of Myrna's closest friends she met while away at college was a girl named Jessica Wongzo, who was also from Jakarta. The two girls were both design majors and came from wealthy families, so they became fast friends. They also became so close to two other Indonesian girls, Hani and Vera, who did almost everything together. But like so many other friendships their age, Jessica and Myrna's seemed to taper off a little bit when college graduation came around. Jessica planned to stay in Australia, even becoming a permanent resident because her dad owned a business there, while Myrna decided to return home to Indonesia with her boyfriend. Their friends Hanny and Vera also went back. Jessica and Myrna did their best to stay in contact despite being hundreds of miles apart. They texted each other and talked over social media, and they even promised to see each other. But as time went on, they both seemed to move on with their adult lives, something that's pretty common for one-time college friends. Myrna had her mind set on marrying her boyfriend and starting a family. She sometimes talked about opening up her own coffee shop someday because she loved coffee so much. Myrna was what you would describe as a, quote, coffee snob. On the other hand, Jessica was struggling and living a much different life. She had an on-and-off-again boyfriend named Patrick, who most of her friends didn't like. And she was reportedly suffering from a drug and alcohol problem that eventually caused her to lose her job. In 2014, Myrna went back to Sydney to visit with some of her old college friends, including Jessica. Even though the two of them had drifted apart over the last couple of years, Myrna hoped the visit would bring them closer together, but that's not exactly what happened. During that 2014 trip, Myrna and Jessica met up for dinner to catch up with each other on their lives since college. Myrna asked Jessica if she was dating anyone, and Jessica told her about her on-and-off-again boyfriend, Patrick. But however Jessica described Patrick didn't seem to impress Myrna. In fact, after hearing about their relationship, Myrna told Jessica that she was too good for him and she should break up with him. Now, on the surface, this was just a typical conversation between two old college girlfriends. Each talks about their relationships, and that's it. But Jessica didn't seem to take it that way. Yes, she talked about how bad her relationship was with this guy, but she didn't feel like Myrna knew the whole story or that she was too quick to judge. So that's when Jessica apparently got up from the table and stormed out of the restaurant without paying and leaving Myrna by herself. At that point, it seemed like the friendship might be over for good, and the two girls went their separate ways. After that 2014 trip, Myrna returned back to Indonesia, where she had her dream wedding in Bali. Because of the fight they had in Australia, Myrna decided not to invite Jessica. But that didn't mean Jessica didn't know about the wedding. All thanks to social media, Jessica saw almost every picture posted from Myrna's wedding, and she knew right away that she was intentionally not invited. It must have felt like a gut punch seeing someone you once called your best friend so happy and you not being a part of it. And not only was she not a part of it, but she continued to struggle, even more so right after college. While Myrna was getting married, the police were called to Jessica's apartment at least three separate times because of suicide threats. In 2015, Jessica allegedly told her boyfriend that she was going to kill herself with a knife. And then a few months later, the cops were called again because Patrick feared Jessica had overdosed. In one particular incident, she apparently got so drunk that she crashed her car, breaking one of her ribs. In another incident, she lost her job at New South Wales Ambulance for not being able to perform the basic duties of her job because of the alcohol abuse. By 2016, Jessica decided it might be time to return back home to Indonesia. It had been a rough few years in Australia after college, and maybe being home would help her finally get on the right path. So in December of 2015, before the move, Jessica texted her friends back in Indonesia that she was planning on coming home and wanted to see if everyone could get together, maybe grab some drinks or dinner. The text was sent to Myrna, Hanny, and Vera, and the girls eventually decided to meet up for coffee and drinks. On January 6, 2016, Jessica, Myrna, Hanny, and Vera planned to meet up at an upscale coffee shop in Jakarta, the Oliver Cafe, inside a trendy shopping mall. The plan was for the three girls to meet up around 5, and Vera would come meet a little bit later since she didn't get off work until after 6. It was supposed to be just a casual thing, so the exact time the girls got there wasn't really a big deal. But Jessica got to the coffee shop a lot earlier. Based on the CCTV footage from inside the cafe, Jessica got there at 3:30 p.m., a full 90 minutes before Myrna and Hanny were supposed to get there. Cameras captured her checking into the hostess station while she texted the other two girls to see what drinks they wanted so she could have them pre-ordered. Jessica offered to pay for her friends' drinks as a way to reconnect with them. Myrna ordered her usual Vietnamese iced coffee, a drink consisting of sweetened condensed milk and a dark roast that slowly goes through a drip filter. Jessica is captured on camera a few minutes later, leaving the coffee shop and returning 40 minutes later. This time, she was carrying 3 large Bath & Body Works shopping bags, all containing small bottles of liquid soap. They were supposed to be gifts for the girls, another way to try to rekindle things. Once again, Jessica checked in at the front of the coffee shop before being led to a table, table 54. After sitting alone in the large booth for a couple of minutes, she went to the counter to order the drinks at 4:18. The drinks arrived at the table at 4:24, 2 cocktails and an iced coffee. The cocktails were for her and Hanny, and the iced coffee was for Myrna. Additional cameras from inside the cafe captured Jessica putting the 3 large shopping bags on the table, blocking her and the drinks from the camera's view. During this time, Jessica made several movements over the bags and drinks, but none of them could be clearly seen by the cameras. She also opened her purse and looked around. She then changed seats at least twice and seemed to be fidgeting with the bags. Then several minutes later, she placed the shopping bags on the seat next to her. Since the bags were blocking the drinks, it was impossible to know what exactly she was doing or why she even put the bags on the table to begin with. It was a rather large table with plenty of room for the bags to sit on the booth or even on the floor. At no point did anyone else approach the table or touch the drinks. At 5:15, Myrna and Hanny arrived at the cafe together and went directly to the table where Jessica was already seated. Between the time that Jessica got the drinks and when Hanny and Myrna got there, the drinks had sat out for a total of 52 minutes. Cameras captured Jessica giving both of the girls a big hug when they got there, and then they all sat down together at the table. Jessica told her friends that she went ahead and ordered the drinks, and they were already at the booth. She handed Hanny the cocktail and Myrna the iced coffee. Myrna was the first to grab her iced coffee, but right away she sensed something was off. The drink tasted terrible and nothing like it was supposed to. Myrna passed the drink to her friend Hanny, who also took a sip and said that it just didn't taste right. She asked Jessica to taste it, but Jessica said she didn't want to. Within 2 minutes of taking the first couple sips of her iced coffee, Myrna fell off the chair and began to convulse and shake on the floor, with foam coming out of her mouth. Thinking Myrna was having a seizure or some type of other medical emergency, the cafe staff immediately ran over to Myrna and called for an ambulance. Hanny and Jessica also both got up from the table to stand around their friend. Hanny kept calling out Myrna's name to get her to come around and snap out of it. But Jessica's behavior was noticeably different. Instead of kneeling down to the ground with her friend, she seemed more interested in blaming the cafe staff for what was happening. While Myrna continued to convulse on the floor, some of the staff tried performing CPR the best they could. But everyone was too late. 27-year-old Myrna was pronounced dead as soon as she arrived at the hospital, which was only 5 minutes away. She was dead less than 1 hour after taking a few sips of her iced coffee. Myrna's sudden death completely shattered her family and new husband. No one could quite believe when they found out what happened, including her father and twin sister. It just didn't make any sense. How does a seemingly healthy 27-year-old young woman suddenly die after meeting up with some friends at a local coffee shop? There just had to be more to this story. Now, the first thought was that this was some type of accident. Maybe something accidentally poisoned Myrna's drink, a bad or expired ingredient. So back at the cafe, the staff began searching around the kitchen to see what could have caused Myrna to get so sick so quickly. They checked the ingredients labels, the kitchen, and even the freezer. But they couldn't find anything unusual. None of the other 10 iced coffees they served that day had any problems with them. It seemed to be only Myrna's drink that had something in it. According to one of the waiters who smelled Myrna's drink, it had a strange orange color. He described it as looking like turmeric had been put in it. And when he smelled it, it smelled awful, although he never tasted it. That's when Myrna's family started to become suspicious. Why was her iced coffee the only one that seemed bad? Right away, the police wanted an autopsy to be done, but Myrna's family refused. Because of religious reasons, Myrna's body never received a full autopsy, like you'd probably expect to see here in the United States. Like most of Indonesia's population, Myrna's family was Muslim. And as people who practice the Muslim faith, autopsies aren't routinely performed to avoid violating the religious rules against disturbing the body. So Myrna's family declined the full autopsy. So only a very small part of her body was actually examined by the medical examiner, not the entire thing. The agreement was they could only take samples of her blood, tissue, and stomach contents, but they weren't allowed to cut her open. So that meant they couldn't fully examine her heart, brain, or lungs. When the police collected blood samples from Myrna about 70 minutes after she was pronounced dead, they didn't find anything. No type of poison was found in her bile, liver, or urine. But with the family's permission, the medical examiner did find bleeding and irritation in her stomach and intestines, suggesting the presence of a poison. There was also blackening on the inside of Myrna's mouth, and when they examined her stomach contents 3 days later, they found a small amount of cyanide in her system. The police went back to the cafe, but unfortunately, the iced coffee that Myrna drank had already been thrown out, so they weren't able to test it for cyanide. This meant there was no way of knowing exactly where the cyanide came from. They also considered the possibility that someone working in the cafe might have slipped the cyanide in her drink. But they didn't find any evidence on the CCTV cameras of anyone messing with her drink. And after the drinks were delivered to the table, no one touched them. While they were at the cafe, the investigators interviewed all the staff working that day, and several of them commented on how strange they thought Jessica was acting. Unlike their other friend, Jessica seemed just cold and almost standoffish. It wasn't your typical behavior of a friend to witness their other friend dying right in front of their eyes. The staff also told the police that Jessica kept yelling at them, saying that they were the ones who put something in her drink. This was also strange because at this point, everyone just thought she was having some type of medical emergency. There was no reason to suspect anyone put anything into her drink, so she sort of inserted this narrative all on her own. In the police's mind, this all added up to one thing. Jessica was the one who put cyanide in Myrna's iced coffee. Myrna's family also suspected it was Jessica. Their suspicion about her started right when they got to the hospital. When they got there, Hanny and Jessica were already there, but their behavior couldn't be more different. Hanny was hysterical, not just because she lost one of her best friends, but also because it happened right in front of her own eyes. But Jessica seemed completely calm, almost disconnected from everything. Then after Myrna's death, Jessica allegedly sent Myrna's twin sister a really strange article about toxic iced coffee, basically suggesting that the coffee she drank might have already been bad and wasn't because someone did anything to it. Investigators questioned Jessica about Myrna's death on 5 separate occasions, but the one thing they weren't able to do was determine if Jessica had any access to cyanide. Because the whole thing was considered a medical emergency at the time, the police never had a chance to search Jessica or any of her belongings that day. So, if she did have access to cyanide, she would have likely gotten rid of it before she was ever questioned by the police. On another strange note, Jessica allegedly threw away the pair of jeans that she wore that day. Her mother later claimed she did it because they had a tear in them, but either way, the clothes she wore are now long gone. In the CCTV footage from inside the cafe, Jessica was seen repeatedly rubbing and scratching her hands. A common symptom of handling cyanide is skin irritation and itchiness. But this is just pure speculation. There's absolutely no proof that Jessica ever handled cyanide because it was never found in her possession. There was also the question about how she could have gotten access to it. For someone to buy cyanide in Indonesia, you need a specific reason, and the sale is always documented. This basically helps to make sure that whoever's buying it actually needs it, and that there's going to be proof of the sale in something, or in the case of something like this happening. But despite the police's best efforts, they never found any evidence that Jessica had purchased it. There was no proof of sale. The only rumor that seemed to spread was that she might have gotten it illegally from a fishing village. At the time, some fishermen used cyanide because it helped slow down the fish, making them easier to catch. But again, that's just pure speculation. Someone as wealthy and resourceful as Jessica could have gotten it some other way. It wouldn't be the first time someone's gotten their hands on illegal cyanide. As part of their investigation, the Indonesian police got their hands on a lot of documents talking about Jessica's not-so-great life in Australia. They included a restraining order that her ex-boyfriend Patrick had filed against her. There were reports about at least 4 previous suicide attempts that required hospitalization. Jessica was also accused of displaying threatening behavior to coworkers. And of course, there were the police reports from that car accident that she caused when she was drunk. All of these documents seem to point out just how unstable Jessica was at the time. So the theory became that Myrna had the life that Jessica always wanted but didn't have. She wanted to be in a steady, healthy relationship, but the boyfriend she once had filed a restraining order against her. On the other hand, Myrna was married and had a dream wedding in Bali. Jessica suffered from depression and she suffered from substance abuse, while Myrna hardly drank and always seemed happy. So the story eventually became Jessica was jealous of Myrna, and the only way to address this jealousy was to kill her. And when Jessica arrived back in Indonesia, the plan all along was to murder her. So 3 weeks after Myrna died, on January 30th, 2016, the police arrested Jessica outside a hotel that she checked into without telling anyone. She said she was there trying to hide out from all of the media surrounding her house. But Myrna's family believed she was trying to flee the country. Either way, Jessica was charged with premeditated murder, which carries a maximum sentence of the death penalty, which in Indonesia means death by a firing squad. Mirna's family was fully on board with the death penalty. Even though Jessica was once best friends with Mirna, they wanted her to pay the ultimate price for what they believed she did. They also didn't have any doubt about whether Jessica was guilty or not. There wasn't any other explanation as to how the cyanide ended up in her drink. Even Mirna's husband told the authorities that he never felt comfortable with Mirna hanging out with Jessica alone. Anytime they saw each other, he or another friend would go with her. And that's exactly what happened on the day she died. Mirna didn't want to see Jessica by herself, so she brought a friend with her. The death penalty was eventually taken off the table by prosecutors after an agreement was made between the Australian and Indonesian governments. Although Jessica was originally from Indonesia, she was also a legal resident of Australia at the time, which doesn't allow the death penalty. The case instantly became a media sensation all throughout Indonesia. Even the rest of the world became captured by the story. A girl poisons her former best friend with cyanide through a cup of iced coffee. It was a script meant for a Hollywood horror film, and it was called Indonesia's Trial of the Century, similar to what the O.J. Simpson case was. People also became morbidly fascinated with it. Hundreds of people began showing up at the cafe, wanting to sit in the same exact booth. They even ordered her drink, a large iced coffee. On certain days, the cafe sold out of it because they received so many orders. And very quickly, Jessica became labeled as the coffee killer. 5 months after Jessica's arrest, her murder trial began on June 15th, 2016. The entire 135-day trial was broadcast live and immediately became a national media spectacle. More than 500 police officers were on hand, not just for security, but also to separate the two crowds of supporters, those backing Jessica and the family and supporters of Mirna. Indonesians became obsessed with the story, a story about two affluent young women having bad blood in a country sometimes known for police corruption. Jessica herself even became a public figure after she was often photographed smiling for the media, earning both judgment and supporters. Unlike criminal trials in the U.S., Jessica's case wouldn't be decided by a jury of her peers. Instead, it was heard in front of a panel of judges, a practice that is common in countries that use civil law. The prosecution and defense went head-to-head. Both had their fair share of circumstantial and forensic evidence on their sides. A total of 46 witnesses testified at trial, including Mirna's father, husband, twin sister, and many of the employees who worked at the cafe. Jessica also had her fair share of witnesses who testified on behalf of her defense. The prosecution relied heavily on everything we've already talked about, mostly circumstantial evidence, including the CCTV footage and the interviews with the cafe workers. There was also the evidence of Jessica's past mental health issues, substance abuse, and the turbulent relationship with Mirna over the years. The prosecution also presented evidence that Jessica had been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder. But they also had strange arguments, like how the shape of Jessica's face and the color of her eyes meant that she was guilty. According to one of the prosecution's experts, Jessica had to be guilty because of the shape of her nose and the lack of sparkle in her eyes. This same psychologist also testified that Jessica's dark brown eyes meant that she had evil in her. Of course, Jessica's defense team tried challenging this testimony, saying that it was baseless and didn't have any proof of her actual guilt. It's actually kind of surprising that this type of testimony was even allowed in court at all, but it was. When it came to the forensic evidence, the prosecution had a lot of holes they needed to try to explain. Like, why wasn't cyanide found in Myrna's blood samples taken 70 minutes after she died? But 3 days later, when they examined her stomach contents, that's when they found trace amounts of the poison, 0.2 milligrams, which is below a lethal dose. According to the defense, that's about the same amount that's in 10 apple seeds. According to the prosecution's expert toxicologist, the coffee cup had about 7,400 milligrams of cyanide in it, and he estimated Myrna had consumed anywhere from 12.8 milligrams to 27.2 milligrams. Now, the defense did point out that if there was that much cyanide in the coffee, then anyone else who was around the coffee would have experienced symptoms too. That amount would have been enough to give off fumes, yet Hanny, who also tasted the coffee, had no symptoms. And the waiter, who smelled the coffee later on and said that it looked orange, didn't experience any adverse symptoms either. Another hole the prosecution tried to fill was exactly how Jessica got the cyanide and how she was able to slip it into the drink without anyone knowing. Remember, the prosecution could only theorize about what had happened. Jessica put the three large shopping bags on the table at the cafe so that no one would see her tampering with Myrna's coffee. Then once she was done, she put the bags on the floor. But that's only a guess at best. None of the cameras actually caught her doing any of that, and there was no proof she ever bought cyanide or had it in her possession. Jessica's defense team introduced a new theory and a new suspect at trial, Myrna's husband, Arif. They claimed that one of the baristas from the cafe came forward to say that he was paid money by Arif to poison Myrna. However, when this barista was brought to the stand to testify, he denied everything, saying that the conversation never happened. So when that theory seemed to fall apart, the defense took a different direction. They pushed back against the idea that Myrna died of cyanide poisoning at all. They said Myrna couldn't have died from cyanide poisoning because there was no toxicological evidence of her actually ingesting cyanide. And while there was some cyanide found in her stomach, it wasn't enough to kill her. They also argued that the only way to conclude if she died from cyanide poisoning was through an autopsy. But, as we already know, because of religious reasons, her family refused to have one done. So again, according to the defense, there's absolutely no forensic proof. The defense also challenged the police's investigation of the case. The first thing was that the cafe didn't seem to have any camera footage of the police actually removing the alleged poisoned coffee from the scene. Yet, they seemed to have every footage of Jessica from that day. They also argued how the police poured the coffee into a different bottle, but couldn't produce the chain of evidence indicating when they did it or the details about it to show that there wasn't any type of contamination. Another strange part when it comes to the forensic evidence was Myrna's skin color. According to the medical report, her skin turned blue shortly after she was pronounced dead. However, the defense team argued that this seemed to contradict what we know about cyanide poisoning. Typically, when someone is poisoned with cyanide, their skin turns a reddish color. They don't turn blue. So this was yet just another one of the defense's arguments to suggest that she was never poisoned at all. Jessica decided to testify in her own defense, something that is pretty typical in Indonesia. But when asked specific questions about the details from that day, she didn't seem to remember much. Most of the questions the judge asked, she responded with, "I don't know," or "I don't remember." When they asked her about why she put the shopping bags on top of the table, covering the drinks instead of on the floor, she said she didn't remember. She was asked why she didn't drink the drink when Myrna said that it tasted funny. And again, Jessica said she didn't remember why. Sometimes during Jessica's testimony, she seemed upset and was visibly crying. But other times, she was more cool, calm, and collected. So it was really hard to get a good read on how she was actually feeling at the time. After 5 months of testimony, the panel of judges took the case and delivered their verdict. Then on October 27th, 2016, they returned back with their decision. After reading the 377-page verdict, the judges found Jessica guilty of premeditated murder. Even though they noted several holes in the prosecution's case, they still felt like the case was compelling enough against Jessica to warrant a guilty verdict. They accepted the prosecution's motive that Jessica was jealous of Myrna, and that's why she decided to kill her. She was also angry about Myrna telling her to break up with her boyfriend. They also said that they thought everything was entirely premeditated. Jessica returned to Indonesia simply to commit this crime. She planned everything from top to bottom, from getting to the cafe 90 minutes before her friends, to placing the three large shopping bags on top of the table so that no one could see her slip the cyanide in Myrna's iced coffee. The judges also believed that Jessica had plenty of time to change her mind. The drinks sat at the table for more than 45 minutes before Myrna showed up, which gave her ample time to back out. But she didn't. She stuck to her original plan. In the end, Jessica was sentenced to 20 years in jail and was lucky enough to escape the death penalty. Not long after she was sentenced, Jessica gave a statement saying that the trial was unfair and one-sided. She continued to maintain her innocence and said she would never poison or kill someone she once considered her best friend. Her family also continues to stand by her side, believing she is innocent. Since then, Jessica has repeatedly tried to appeal her conviction but has been denied every time. Currently, she's serving her 20-year sentence in an Indonesian prison for women. She may be eligible for parole at some point before the end of her sentence, but not many prisoners are ever granted parole in Indonesia. In order for her to be released, the victim's family and the community both have to agree, which seems highly unlikely to happen in this situation. Jessica and Myrna's entire story has been well documented in the popular Netflix documentary Ice Cold: Murder, Coffee, and Jessica Wongzo. The documentary dives deep into the case and interviews many people directly involved, including Myrna's outspoken father and twin sister. If you're interested in learning more about this story, I really encourage you to check out the documentary and come up with your own conclusions about what really happened. You might even change your mind after listening to this episode and then watching the documentary. So if it's available on Netflix where you live, watch it for yourself, and you can decide if you think Jessica really is the coffee killer. To share your thoughts on the story, be sure to follow the show on Instagram and Facebook. To find out what I think about the case, sign up to become a patron at patreon.com/forensictales. After each episode, I release a bonus episode where I share my personal thoughts and opinions about the case. Don't forget to subscribe to Forensic Tales so you don't miss an episode. We release a new episode every Monday. If you love the show, consider leaving us a positive review or tell friends and family about us. You can also help support this show through Patreon. Thank you so much for joining me this week. Please join me next week. We'll have a brand new case and a brand new story to talk about. Until then, remember, not all stories have happy endings. Forensic Tales is a Rockefeller Audio production. The show is written and produced by me, Courtney Fretwell Ariola. For a small monthly contribution, you can help create new compelling cases for the show, help fund research, and assist with production and editing costs. For supporting the show, you'll become one of the first to listen to new ad-free episodes and snag exclusive show merchandise not available anywhere else. To learn about how you can support the show, head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/forensictales, or simply click the support link in the show notes. You can also support the show by leaving a positive review or telling friends and family about us. Forensic Tales is a podcast made possible by our Patreon producers, Tony A., Christine B., Sherry A., Michael D., Nicola, Jerry M., Brian W., Megan G., Urelli, Jerry, Ann F., Ken S., Carol A., and Angela L. If you'd like to become a producer of this show, head over to our Patreon page or send me an email at courtney@forensictales.com to find out how you can become involved. For a complete list of sources used in this episode, please visit forensictales.com. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Until then, remember, not all stories have happy endings.